This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I said I'd recruit more police officers. I did. I said we'd get crime down. It is starting to come down again. I said we'll support more victims of crime, and we are doing that. It's about being proactive in your communications, but also making sure that you're delivering on what people elected you to do.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And I'm joined this week by Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And our special guest is Kent Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Scott, who explains what his role involves. First up, Dan, what's been going on in your neck of the woods?
So not too long ago, I got some deja vu watching yet another big solar farm get rejected. It was a 40 megawatt solar farm out in the sticks, but Swaleborough Council ended up throwing it out, which is increasingly topical given the new government's penchant for renewable energy.
Quite. Whereabouts is this proposed solar farm, and what does 40 megawatts actually mean?
So in the developer's estimation, 40 megawatts is about the power needed to keep 11,500 homes running for a year. And also bear in mind that any solar farm of 50 megawatts or more is nationally significant in the decisions made by the government, not by council planning committees. So it's nothing to be sniffed at in terms of size. Location-wise, it was meant to be on a pretty huge area of farmland between Borden and a little hamlet called Ode Street, sort of in the general area of Sittingbourne.
Is this the fact that it was agricultural land that incensed councillors so much?
Yeah, I mean, that was the main point of contention. People were not very happy about it. The farmland is grade one farmland, which in the system used in this country is, you know, the best quality and most versatile farmland. One Green councillor, who is himself a farmer, described building solar farms on that kind of land as insane, and basically said the landowner just doesn't want to farm anymore and that they should sell it up to someone who will use the land properly. He recommended that there are other places in the borough, you know, poorer quality farmland nearer to the coast, which are likely to flood in about 40 years, where it could be where you should put solar farms instead, because solar farms, big ones, generally have a lifespan of about 40 years. And he also said, you know, places like rooftops and car parks would be ideal rather than farmland. Mm. So the planning committee ended up tossing it out.
What are the developers getting up on this?
Not sure for certain. They told me they're looking at their options, but planning officers were recommending that the committee approve it. So there's a good chance that developers might try their luck at an appeal at the planning inspectorate. But more interestingly, for the sort of future implications of it, Swale has what you could call an ambitious climate target for the whole borough to be net zero by 2030, so only 6 years from now. New national government is pretty keen on solar farms as well. You know, Ed Miliband approved, new energy secretary, 3 huge solar farms very shortly after taking office. But it illustrates sort of long-term tension in that many sort of mid-size solar farms pretty much have to be built on agricultural land. And the government, you know, is therefore basically at the mercy of landowners deciding to sell up their land to be used for that purpose. So if net zero targets like that of Swaleborough Council are actually going to be met, it will probably involve, you know, much more need to involve much more direct state intervention and maybe even, you know, compulsory purchasing of unused or underused land for solar farms. But whether any level of government really has the appetite for that remains to be seen.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Turning to Robert, what about Medway? What's been happening there?
Well, last week we saw many issues for Labour in Kent, and Medway was no different. Something which caught international eyes, which was Lauren Edwards, the new MP for Rochester and Strood, and a councillor on Medway Council as well, had some of her old offensive tweets dug up by internet sleuths. They were found and picked up a bit of traction throughout the day, with the general comment being a criticism of Keir Starmer, saying he'd been quick to act against MPs voting to scrap the two-child benefit cap, but not these offensive tweets.
But it only got bigger from there, didn't it?
Yes, so after a couple of hours, Lauren Edwards issued an apology, and then after a couple of hours after that, that apology had 3 million views all on its own. The following day, Elon Musk, the controversial owner of X, formerly Twitter, who has taken a bit of a dislike to the new Labour government, to put it lightly, shared a screenshot of a quote tweet which put Lauren Edwards' apology next to the offensive tweet she was apologising for. This also got multi-millions of views and drew more attention and pressure. But so far, there's been no response from the National Labour Party and no suggestion that Edwards will face any punishment for the tweets.
OK. And what about Medway itself? Has there been a reaction?
Well, so locally, the Medway Tories have written to council leader Vince Maple asking him to investigate the comments, asking whether he condemned them, and has written And they have written to the council's monitoring officer because they don't feel the administration is taking the Nolan principles of public life seriously. Councillor Maple has now responded after keeping quiet on the issue for 5 days, saying basically Edwards has apologised. It was a long time ago. These tweets were from 2009 and he would not be looking into this any further.
So what have you been working on, Simon?
A new survey out this week suggests that Kent is one of the sickest, as in most ill, places in the country. It's the 10th highest in terms of the spend on prescriptions. This is based on official NHS figures before 22-23. So on average, local people cost their integrated care board £181 per person in medication charges, all of which are covered by the NHS. And the latest figures show that more than 30 million prescriptions were made out in Kent during that period at a cost over £352 million. And based on a population of about 1.9 million, it averages 181 per patient.
So if Kent is only the 10th, who tops the list and who spends the least on their prescriptions?
Top of the sick list is Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, which has far fewer prescriptions. That's around about 20 million at a high cost, 33 million to its just over 1 million inhabitants. So it works out at about £332 each. So you've got fewer prescriptions, but more of them costing more. So that's why with a lower population. And South East London roughly has the per capita spend of about 106 million. The study was carried out by NHSdiscountoffers.co.uk and analysed the NHS Business Service Authority's data on prescription costs and how it compared to the coinciding population of each ICB, each board. And they covered the 22-23 period and looked at the records of all 42 ICBs.
Is it really that simple? And the NHS famously are convoluted in its organisation of its finances.
Well, these are the broad statistical sort of, you know, interpretations, and you have to remember that this covers the cost of the cost to the NHS of prescriptions, not the people actually pay for them themselves. But the NHSdiscountoffers.co.uk, this suggests that areas that invest the most in prescriptions often have to do so because of the higher prescription volumes or due to the higher cost of medicines they are investing in, potentially indicating the greater prevalence of chronic conditions or more comprehensive healthcare coverage in these regions. So it's not just a case of being ill, it's also a case of having the quality and the actual sort of volume of prescriptions that are required in any one area.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
At just 31, he was the youngest police and crime commissioner in the country when he was first elected back in 2016. A lifelong Conservative, Matthew Scott was re-elected in May for a third term to serve Kent. Welcome, Matthew. Thanks for giving us your time today.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Listen, just for the benefit of the listeners who may not be aware, what does the Kent Police and Crime Commissioner do?
Well, for me, the role is about two things. Firstly, it's to be a victim's champion, to look after victims of crime, no matter what point of the journey that they're in, to make it as easy as possible to report crime, that they get a good investigation, and that they're supported all the way throughout the process, as well as get any support that they need from charities and others to support them with their other needs. And the other is to be an advocate for the local communities, to make sure that we're working together with them, to listen to their views and make sure that the police's priorities are reflected in what the residents want to see. So I set a police and crime plan. I hold the chief and constable account for delivering that plan. Ultimately, we do have the ability to hire and fire the chief constable should there be a complete failure of force performance, but we're not in that area. We commission services for victims of crime, as I've already said. We're responsible for all the money, the council tax, which comes in and setting the council tax rate. And we work in partnership with other organisations to prevent crime from happening in the first place.
This is something that you and I have talked about before. You'll agree that few people really know what you do or what the role entails. I mean, how do you go about changing that perception?
It's about getting out there. I mean, over the last 8 years, I put a high focus on going out and doing public engagement engagements, going out on the beat with officers, talking to members of the public, being as open with our communication as we possibly can be. We use social media, but we use other platforms as well in order to communicate with the public, receive their feedback too. And it's about doing what you say you're going to do as well. And that's really important. I said I'd recruit more police officers. I said we'd get crime down. It is starting to come down again. I said we'll support more victims of crime, and we are doing that. It's about being proactive in your communications, but also making sure that you're delivering on what people elected you to do.
Tell us about your journey into politics.
Well, my journey into politics, it sort of began prior to university. It was something I was always interested in. I first got involved in the party when I was 17, and it wasn't in time for the 2001 general election, but I sort of became involved in council elections and European elections after that. I got elected as a councillor in 2006 in Bexley in southeast London. I served there for 4 years. I've been a school governor, a community advocate, and I stood at the 2015 general election in Leighton and Wanstead against the brilliant John Cryer. That was a real experience. And then the opportunity after that general election came to put my name forward to be my party's nominee for this role. So in terms of my political history, it's been, politics has always been in my life. It's been something I've always been interested in, and not interested in for the sake of being interested in, but actually, I know it sounds like a cliche, but actually wanting to do things that do make a difference, that people see, that people feel, not just things that you can attach yourself to because the government's given X amount of funding for something, but actually I can point at things we've done in Kent and go, you know what, before we did the uplift programme, there was 460 more police officers. I helped deliver those. There are victim support services. There are people are getting support that would never have got that service before because it didn't exist. So for me, it's about those tangible, practical things that you can actually deliver for people.
Your career, has been dominated thus far by the world of politics. I mean, what sort of real world experience do you can you point to?
It depends on your view of real world. I mean, I've been, like lots of people, being a school governor. I ran a community centre. I've had other roles. I'm chair of a company now. Lots of people have been involved in business. We set the policing procurement company up from scratch. I led that work over the course of the last 5 years in terms of making sure that we were all compliant, that we are all properly constituted, etc. So, there are actual proper things that I have done, but I don't think we should also be so dismissive of people who have political backgrounds, because one of my great strengths has been that I know how to get things done, that having worked at Westminster and worked at Whitehall, I knew exactly where to go, how to get things done, who to work with in order to achieve things. So, I have got lots of different experiences in my life, but also the fact that I know how to get things done, I think, has benefited Kent quite a lot.
The relatively new Chief Constable, Tim Smith, is the man you have to hold to account, as you mentioned earlier on. And I'm sure there's much that you agree on and that much that you agree that you must strive to try and achieve. What have you disagreed on?
I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think we have disagreed on anything, because we have been, since I appointed him, we have been at one on our mission for the residents of Kent, to cut crime, to support victims and to build trust. That's what we're both united in doing. When he has asked for my support on individual projects, yes, I've made sure that there's been rigorous scrutiny, that the numbers add up, that the financial consequences have been considered. But actually, I'd really struggle to find an example for you where we have disagreed. And, it isn't all about disagreements and things like that. Actually, the strength of our relationship and why things work here in Kent is because you have a PCC and a Chief Constable who actually get on with each other. That's not the same everywhere else.
Perhaps you've just answered the question. Has there been anything that Mr. Smith has done where you felt his approach has been wrong?
No, I don't think so. And frankly, that would be for me to have that conversation with him. But I think on the whole, he's done a really good job since he's been in post. I appointed him temporary chief constable almost 2 years ago. And things have gone from strength to strength, I think. We've seen some improvement in our performance. We've seen some crime numbers coming down. We're seeing more people being dealt with for particular offences. Again, I think he's doing a good job, and I would struggle to find an example of where we've, disagreed on anything like that. And I think it is that unity, the ability to have those constructive conversations, that actually works to our strength here.
Yeah. Is there anything that you have regrets over that you feel perhaps you could have done better in the past 8 years?
That's an interesting one. I think we can always look back at programs that maybe haven't worked and things that we maybe would like to have seen some better results from. You know, you'll see some of our programs. And I'll give you one example. We had our domestic abuse and stalker perpetrator program, which was funded by central government. And it's a good thing in theory. It really is. And we absolutely have to be challenging the behaviour of perpetrators. But in its first few years, we really weren't seeing the referrals coming through. And it does make you think whether we did take the right approach. And I think we've made some good changes to it since. I think we have got some more referrals coming in now. And we'll review that again at the end. I think it would be, you know, examples of things like that where maybe that kind of scheme hasn't, you know, it hasn't had the numbers that I would have liked, but we're constantly improving.
Yeah, well, has that got anything to do with the fact that the image of Kent Police has been slightly tarnished in recent years?
How has it been tarnished in recent years?
Well, you know, we've got the Wayne Cousins business. You know that there have been several scandals involving Kent Police and other police forces, and you know, probably perhaps that the appetite for engaging with programmes like that isn't quite as good as it should be.
Well, I think in those circumstances, you do have to have a certain level of buy-in from the people who are going to be subject to those programmes. But, you know, on the whole, there have been some examples of where, you know, Kent Police has had its reputation affected by officers who have committed crimes, who have committed some really terrible things. But the important thing is that the Chief Constable and I, we are committed to rooting those individuals out. Where cases can be made, they'll present charges to the CPS and push for dismissal at gross misconduct hearings where that is possible. And where we can prove that the crime is linked to their service as a police officer, I also have the ability to go after their pension. Now, I know that policing confidence has been knocked generally because of some of those things that you have mentioned. And that's why one of the three main things I ran on during the course of this election was building trust, because there's no point saying rebuild trust or things like that. You have got to just build trust again, because whether it was Kent Police or a Kent Police officer who was involved, or whether they were an officer from another police force, actually we as Policing UK have to take it and say, like we did with the Casey review, is that we have to make sure that we're implementing all of those recommendations, whether they've been directly found against Kent or not. And we are doing those things. So we are trying to build trust. We're still seeing people wanting to become police officers in Kent. We still get more applications than we do for the number of vacancies that we have. But we've still got some work to do in the local community.
Okay. We have a new government, a Labour government under Sir Keir Starmer, which wasn't massively unexpected. But will there be a new approach to the commissioner's role under Labour, as far as you're aware?
I think it's too early to say, really. I mean, they've had 5 or 6 weeks in office, and they've had some very serious policing matters with the protests which have been going on that they've had to deal with. It remains to be seen what that looked like. I've retained my national role as the chair of Blue Light Commercial. There hasn't been any political push or takeover yet in order to have mass removals of Conservatives from positions of responsibility. Those partnerships are maintaining. I think I'd be more concerned about some of the individual decisions that they are taking. We've already been notified, for example, that they're no longer going to fund the Immediate Justice Programme, which, as you know, was something I'm very keen to do. And I will push on with regardless of the funding situation nationally. But I think it will play out a little bit more over time. The police's attention has been focused quite rightly on dealing with protests and riots and disorder.
Sorry.
I think when that...
Yeah, sorry to rewind there. You said that the Immediate Justice Programme, that was something you were quite keen on. You said that the government has now removed funding for that.
Yeah, they absolutely have. Yes, we received notification 2 weeks ago that they were no longer going to fund that programme, which is a real shame, because we've already started work in my office to put together a programme which we would have hoped to have started in October, so that people will pay back to the community if they commit acts of antisocial behaviour. But I'm not going to be deterred by that. So we will locate funding from within my commissioning budget in order to produce a programme of our own. It may not be of the same size as the one that the previous government had committed to, to. But again, it's an early sign of, I think, where some tensions lie. They've come straight in. They've cut that programme. They've reduced the winter fuel allowance for most pensioners. And I think you'll start to see that playing out over the next few months. It's going to be how they take individual decisions as opposed to any great strategic change as of yet.
A few weeks into being Prime Minister, Sir Keir was confronted by widespread rioting in the wake of the Southport killings. He dispensed pretty swift justice, jailing the guilty at the first available opportunity. I mean, for a man like yourself who takes a tough line on these things, it must have been music to your ears.
Well, I think actually we should pay full credit to the police forces who got involved, who policed these protests without fear or favour, who arrested those who were looting, committing acts of violence, who were causing disorder on our streets. Our Crown Prosecution Service, actually, who were working all hours to secure charges against these individuals, and the courts were dispensing swift justice. I think the responsible agencies over the course of the last 2 weeks have done a really good job to send a clear message to people who were involved in disorder. None of this has been any different because there's been a change of government. The mechanisms for this already existed. The National Police Coordination Centre sorted out all the mutual aid requests, so police forces were able to share resources. So when you heard him talk about having this standing army, I think terrible use of terminology, but this cadre of police officers that already existed, we already had national mechanisms in place to do that. Policing has really responded well to the protests and the disorder. It didn't actually need that much of a different approach.
People have been asking the question, surely, that, you know, if you can get the courts to work to get the police to have the powers to be able to put people in prison without talking about sort of prison overcrowding, well, you know, why is this not happening all the time?
Well, in Kent, it certainly is. When we've had protests in our county, whether you go back to 2016 and you had the disorder down at Dover, we had over two years we spent pursuing those people all across the country, securing 64 convictions and 85 years worth of prison sentences. With Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, when they were climbing the gantries on the M25 or they were stopping the traffic. Kent Police was getting straight in there and arresting them. You know, we were not messing around with these individuals in Kent. They were getting stuck in and dealing with them consistently. This isn't a new thing here. And elsewhere in the country, they were doing the same as well. Other police force areas in Surrey and Sussex and Essex, they were getting stuck in and dealing with the disruptive protesters who were impacting upon other people's lives. The mutual aid arrangements, which we had for sending police officers to Bristol or to Dorset or wherever, those were already in place. So policing had a really effective response. So they needed to step up. They needed to step up quickly. They did. And I have full credit to all of our police officers and staff who have been involved in the response to these protests, because actually, I think they've done a really good job.
You have a pretty well-known view on prisons, that you should build them and fill them. Is that really realistic in today's climate?
Well, it's one of those areas where I am quite clear. I think we should be building prisons. We had a commitment under the last government to build more prisons. We have a commitment from the new government to build more prisons. So I very much hope that they fulfil their promise to build more prison places, because we do have a need for those prison places to take in place. That does require, in addition, extra recruitment of prison officers. We need to support our prison officers better, give them the support that they need so that they can deliver what they need to within the prisons themselves, you know, proper education, rehabilitation, treatment, etc. Then you'll start to address the reoffending problem. I don't agree with taking away sentences from people. I know that they've got a program which they're going to start releasing people earlier from September in order to deal with some of the capacity issues. And whilst I understand that as a short-term mechanism, that should never distract from the fact that we do need a prisons building program. We need that capacity in order to deal with the criminality that we have in our country, and that don't want to give anyone the impression that because of capacity issues, they're not going to receive a sentence. It will take time, I accept that, but it's very much a commitment I hope they follow through with.
You're Conservative. Of the six candidates currently in the running to be leader, who would you be backing if you were in Parliament? If you were an MP, who would you be backing?
Tom Tugendhat. I've known Tom for a very long time, naturally. I think he speaks a lot of about what I believe are some of the reasons why we lost the general election and how we need to change going forward. His messaging is very much about what I was talking about earlier. It's about delivering on what you say you are going to do. If you don't do that, then people aren't going to have trust in what you want to do. And I've got a lot of time for for Tom. I think he would be a very good leader. There are some other good candidates in the race. But of course, as you say, my choice will be one of the final two. I very much hope Tom is one of them.
To be honest, I thought you were going to swerve that question. But but who do you think...
Why? I answer your questions.
Yes,
usually.
Of course. Usually, yeah. Who do you think will get through to the final two? I mean, we spoke to someone last week. It was Craig McKinley, actually, who said that he thinks that it'll be a centrist and somebody from the right, and that the members will probably go for the person on the right. Would you go along with that, or do you think that that members have maybe taken a slightly different view in light of what happened at the general election?
It does depend who the final two are. It depends what the parliamentary support is going to be. My feeling is it will probably be Tom versus Robert Jenrick, based on what I'm seeing at the moment. Again, that would be a really good choice for members, I think, and actually you'll get some really good debate. But actually two candidates who I think post-election, whoever wins, could work with each other. You know, I think Tom can win this race. It's one of the reasons why I'm backing him, and I do want to be able to vote for him when the ballot comes later this year.
You've said fairly publicly that, you know, you're committed to your current role, but do you feel as if Westminster beckons?
It's been on the cards in the past, 2015 general election, as a candidate in Leighton and Wanstead, but no, it's not on the cards anytime soon. I'm very happy with what I do. I love being the Police and Crime Commissioner. I think it's one of the best jobs in elected politics. I'm so thrilled and humbled that people have put their faith in me three times to do this role, and I'm very much focused on actually carrying on. So maybe one day in the future, not anytime soon.
Okay, listen, Matthew Scott, thank you so much for your time today. Good to see you as always, and I'm sure we'll catch up again very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
We now know the six candidates who want to become the new Conservative Party leader. But another survey out this week suggests that three-fifths of people, that's about 60%, don't care who becomes the new leader of the Conservative Party. And with me to discuss this a little bit further are Robert and Dan. Robert, it's not great news for the Conservative Party, this.
No, I think it's basically consigning them, at least for the next couple of years, to sort of irrelevancy. And whoever is in charge, it kind of doesn't matter. Nobody's going to pay attention. They could suggest the best ideas in the world and people are really not going to care. Mm. I don't think that is likely, but there we go.
Well, it really depends on how the next sort of 5 years pans out, I suppose. Keir Starmer was only elected after the last election. Corbyn suffered a landslide Conservative victory, yet he came back within 5 years. The whole thing is so volatile that, you know, you can reverse a landslide in one term. But history has shown us that it takes quite a lot of new leaders between landslide defeats. I mean, there were four between John Major and David Cameron, and I think there was a similar number between Brown and Starmer. So it's quite a long time to be in opposition, but not necessarily in these volatile times.
And the Tories have quite an appetite for regicide anyway. They're pretty content to kill off their own leaders quite quickly, as evidenced by the number of prime ministers we've had over the past few years. That might be part of why so few people care about who's next Tory leader, but that might be flattering them. I don't think, after an election victory of this size for any party, I don't think anyone really care who the next leader is. And I imagine if whoever they pick doesn't show measurable signs of progress, which would be impressive if they can, they'll probably get, you know, thrown out pretty fast. I think it was Tony Blair who said being leader of the opposition is the worst job in politics, because pretty much all you can do is talk. And Tory MPs have, well, at least, you know, potential Tory leaders have actually had things to do while they've been in government. So I imagine the next few years, I reckon there might be more than one Tory leader before the next general election.
Well, Michael Howard was saying that he's the former leader of the opposition. He was the third of those four between Major and Cameron. And he said, well, when you're in opposition, effectively, there's no point in the early days making any kind of policy pronouncements, because no one's going to listen to them. And besides which, you've got no way of carrying them out. And if anything, you're just going to have any good ideas nicked by the government. But Tom Tugendhat, who is one of the six, has been speaking to one of the national newspapers. What was he saying for himself?
Well, I think he's technically now shadow security minister, which I believe is just the shadow equivalent of the job he had when he was in government. He made a speech. It wasn't quite a leadership launch speech. It was more of a, technically in his capacity as a shadow minister, but for the most part, it was about crime and law and order in response to the sort of unrest in the wake of the murders in Southport a couple of weeks ago. And for the most part, it was essentially what you'd expect and what anybody in his position would say. He was criticising the government for not responding to the riots fast enough. You know, he was, despite being perceived as a moderate, he was sketching out quite a hardline position on law and order and sort of stricter enforcement of it, and that riots could have been stopped earlier, presumably by sort of stricter control of the movements of people likely to be involved in them.
Do you think that that's because, as Craig McKinley said in this programme a little while ago, that MPs are likely to choose from the six candidates, one from the centre and one from the right, and then the membership, the wider membership, will then choose probably the one that's most right-wing? Do you think Tom Tugendhat, who's a known moderate, is actually trying to make his pitch early on to the wider membership?
Yeah, I mean, he's probably giving it a go. I mean, moderate's one way to put it. I have on good authority people in the Tory party who are on the right tend to call his sort wet. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a position to be on the right of the party, say that, you know, the criticise the government for not enforcing law and order fast enough. It's what any leadership candidate will say about the way the government's responded to the riots, I imagine. But yeah, I guess part of it is that he, he's widely regarded by people on the right of the party as being a bit soft, and he doesn't want to give them any opportunity to say he's too soft on law and order stuff. But I mean, like I say, he's a former soldier, shadow security minister. Mm. This is very much his kind of bag, so I don't think it's surprising. Mm. I think it's what he would say anyway, even if he wasn't sort of afraid of being beat by a candidate on the right of the party. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that Tom took that because it could actually sort of end up quite appealing to the membership. But it really depends on who the person who's also on the ticket. But, you know, what's the latest on this Lauren Edwards business? I mean, it seems to rumble on and on and on.
Yeah, I think, well, so as I said earlier, the local Medway Labour Group say they're not going to investigate on sort of the council side of things. The Labour Party nationally have made no comment about this. I've tried to contact a couple of people I know within the Labour Party and heard nothing back, significant anyway. She's deleted her, or deactivated her Twitter account, so you can't actually see the apology anymore. You can only see it in news reports about this. I think she is trying to keep a very low profile after the sort of mountain of attention which was piled upon her. I think these sorts of things, these, you know, dredging up old social media posts, it has become quite common these days. And I think particularly in this case, it was 15 years ago in 2009. I think the argument, particularly from the local Labour group, has said basically it's a long time ago, she's apologised. And so that's kind of hoping it will all die down within a natural sort of timeline, and hopefully not do too much damage to the branding of the Labour Party. Whether certain Conservative figures will allow that to happen, or at least try and keep it going for as long as possible, that's another thing.
You'd think that these candidates would have learned their lessons by now, that either you don't cap Twitter at all, or you go back and you check right to the very beginning and you delete anything that's possibly could be interpreted the wrong way.
Yeah, I mean, in among the sort of when this tweet was being shared, before it was deleted, a lot of people were saying, you know, these are the new high quality Keir Starmer candidates and various things about the actual comments themselves. But there were a lot of people also saying, how on earth has this been allowed to slip through, particularly in this sort of manicured media age that we live in, where a lot of candidates are very polished and all this sort of thing? A lot of people were asking, well, you've been on Twitter for, I think her account was started in 2008. She's been on the platform for more than sort of 15 years. Who doesn't think, oh, maybe I should check through and see if I've said anything dodgy in that time when, you know, yes, she was involved in politics, she was a parliamentary researcher at the time, but, you know, maybe they weren't always thinking about a political career that would come under this kind of scrutiny, and might think, well, maybe I should go back and just check. You know, nobody thinks they've said anything outrageous, but it's better to be safe than sorry, as we've seen.
Well, maybe you've got, I don't know, four or five candidates who are the your shortlist for the actual candidacy before the election, and then you choose somebody. It might have been an idea before you got to that point of choosing them for the candidacy to actually go through each one of their social media accounts, however long it might take to do so. I mean, I put in mind of the youth commissioner who was taken on by Anne Barnes, who was the first police and crime commissioner, And some bright spark from the Mail on Sunday went through this young woman's Twitter account, went back, I think, about 5 years when she was a teenager, and found some fairly unsavoury stuff, and she didn't last a week. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you think that you would vet these people properly and not just say, take them on their word by saying, look, have you got anything in your past? Any criminal record? No. Have you got anything on social media that you think might embarrass us in the future? No. Well, you won't mind if we go and have a look for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. People in general, and politicians especially, live so much of their lives online these days that, like, of course, this kind of thing is basically unavoidable. I feel like they happen once every few weeks. You hear about some embarrassing tweet or Facebook post or another. For starters, most of these stories, unless it's something truly, truly sensational, they're like as media political bubble as they can be. Normal people don't avidly follow the latest Westminster scandal about the offensive tweets of some MP they've never heard of from 15 years ago. It just doesn't happen. What I find even more unedifying is the sort of response to it. I mean, for starters, obviously, if the shoe was on the other foot, the Labour Party would be acting exactly the same towards the Conservatives if one of their MPs said similarly embarrassing things that long ago. But I just find it such a bizarre spectacle that the actual elected politicians are writing to each other, imploring them, please, you must comment on the offensiveness of one of your colleagues' tweets from, 15 years ago, as if it's a major political scandal, and constantly saying, do you uphold the Nolan principles? Like, you can create some bureaucratic shorthand for sound political judgment. I just find the whole spectacle a bit embarrassing for everyone involved, to be honest.
But I think that relates to the thing we were talking about earlier with the Conservative leader not really being relevant. We're in the early stages of this parliament where Keir Starmer has this massive majority. It's going to be sort of 4 or 5 years until the next general election. So what do the Conservatives have? They've got a long, long walk until they may even face the chance of getting back into office. And, any good idea they suggest is going to be taken by the Labour Party. And so they just need to create enough noise, possibly create some instability if they can. But this sort of, I don't want to say trite, it was serious, offensive things that she said. But again, they're 15 years old and, it's not a substantial issue of the day. But the Conservatives, do they have anything else? What can they do?
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Rob and Dan and to our special guest, Matthew Scott. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics news from across the county. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.